Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today is the entrepreneur, author, and angel investor, Jeremy Silver. Smart, musical, and creative, Jeremy has used his remarkable creativity to boost the UK's digital sector. A music maestro with digital in his DNA, Jeremy started his career working with Massive Attack, Genesis, Meatloaf, as a music executive in the 90s, to name but a few. Now, as chief executive of Digital Catapult, Jeremy is helping the UK's high-potential tech entrepreneurs transform some of their brightest ideas into reality. Now, Jeremy, welcome to Changemakers. I've got to start with Massive Attack, one of my favourite songs ever, Unfinished Symphony. You're the book that I've opened, and now I've got to know much more. Let's talk about you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Let's start with that music career. I mean, some amazing bands there. And also, what a decade, the 90s. I mean, a decade of musical explosion. Quite a happy decade, as I remember it. Let's take ourselves back to the young music executive, the young Jeremy, sort of like working with these iconic brands of the era.
It was an extraordinary time, but I don't think at the time any of us quite realized that this was going to be probably the most successful decade that the music industry had ever seen. And to culminate in a disastrous crash, of course. But but before that, yeah, an enormous kind of uptick of extraordinary activity and amazing bands and amazing range of different sounds as well, really.
I mean, that's my memory of it, was just like the experimentation. I mean, just like, you know, just mentioning three bands there that we just, you know, Massive Attack, Genesis, Meatloaf. I mean, what a range you could get. I mean, the diversity of that.
I never imagined that I was going to work with, I never imagined I was going to work in a record company, let alone work with some of those bands. And so it was a bit of a shock to me. And I was certainly treated like, you know, the newbie and the sort of the wet behind the ears boy when I was sent off on the road with Genesis within about a month of having arrived at Virgin Records back in 1991. And they were doing a town hall tour of the UK. So we were playing places like Wolverhampton Civic Centre and other similarly glamorous locations, which was kind of amazing to see Genesis, who had just come off the road from a stadium tour of the US, putting their entire stadium rig into Wolverhampton Civic Hall. That was quite interesting. Half of it was in the parking lot in the backyard there. So, you know, it was an interesting time.
And I mean, a lot of people talk about the 90s as possibly the last really happy decade. And of course, music was such an important part of that, of, you know, and not just of the, I guess, the social, cultural, creative circuit, but I mean, you know, even politics was defined by musical choices. Things can only get better. I mean, you know, that was the era where optimism and positivity and hope were very much the order of the day. Was that really, I guess, the seedbed for your career as a very optimistic person, I think, in terms of how some of that character was forged, do you think?
Well, I thought it was an extraordinary thing to be able to spend time working with bands like that. And I discovered that one of the things that was really interesting was that the more successful the artist I worked with, the more professionally nice they were. But of course, professionally nice and actually nice aren't necessarily the same thing. But it did make it possible to work with people who, I mean, you know, Meatloaf, who I, you know, when they first told me I was going to have to work with Meatloaf, I think I thought, well, this is the greatest challenge to my professional credentials I've ever experienced. How on earth am I going to work with this guy? But, it, you know, he turned out to be the hardest working, most amenable, most brilliant character that I, you know, I could have hoped to work with.
Two out of three ain't bad. I mean, no, absolutely. Now, you also have delivered an extraordinary TED talk looking at the evolution of the Verve's classic song, Bittersweet Symphony. Just tell us, why? I mean, an extraordinary talk, I thought. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, it's a talk that just traces the evolution of one particular piece of music and its roots in Black American gospel songs, and the way in which that particular song started life in one place, probably as part of an oral tradition, probably not owned by anybody, but passed from family to family, probably from church to church, and then evolved and was taken up by the Rolling Stones, who transformed it and made it their own. And then the weirdest twist was the fact that their manager decided at the time that what the Stones needed was an album of classical versions of their songs, which it would seem the Stones were not in the least bit interested in producing. And so he got this this other guy, the manager, Andrew Luke Oldham, was an extraordinary character. He got this other guy who was a classical composer, essentially to write versions of all these songs. And so produced something which really had very, very little to do with the original. But that piece that he wrote, which was for This May Be the Last Time, which was the song that Bittersweet Symphony originated from, that was the orchestral piece that the Verve then sampled. And then the Stones sued them for all the rights on it, even though they themselves had virtually nothing to do with it at all. So it sort of gives you a sense of the kind of venal nature of the industry, the willingness to litigate on the slightest point, and the total injustice of where does credit really reside in all of this?
I mean, that certainly was one side of that story. But you also said in the talk something that I felt, for those of us and, well, I guess an entire planet living in lockdown, you said music allows us to empathize and discover other people's experiences. In terms of the role of music today in a world where we are apart, where things are so different, so difficult, bring us up to date in the role of music for you, and indeed the role of music in society.
There's an extraordinary book by Oliver Sacks called Musicophilia, in which he tracks the experiences of various people who've suffered forms of brain damage throughout their lives, and the way that music has proved resilient within their systems, despite the fact that they couldn't speak or they couldn't recognize family members and so on. And the sort of implication of his argument is that music is somehow laid down in something very primitive and very fundamental in our brain, in almost a different system from language or other parts of expression. And I think that is how we all connect with music to a greater or lesser degree. It connects us rhythmically, it connects to the very mechanics of our being, and gives us an escape because of that, which none of us still, I think, fully understand. But when we get captured by a piece of music, it takes us to a place that we couldn't imagine getting to in any other way. And of course, lots and lots of individual artists have dramatized that, have taken that in different places, have given us insights and experiences that we wouldn't otherwise be able to have. And I think that we've all, in different ways, found music to be more and more important during lockdown. And in a way, the lack of live music, I think, has been felt even more acutely because we feel so cloistered and claustrophobic, really.
Claustrophobic. I was thinking you mentioned sort of like it sort of fulfills some elemental needs. I mean, Katie Derham, the Proms presenter, was saying the other day that the very act of singing is one of the very few times you actually breathe correctly, that it's not just for the soul and the creative, it's actually just for physical well-being, that music has got so much to give on that front. Now let's move on to Digital Medieval, a great title, I've got to say. And I suppose the question, if we are in medieval times, is there a digital renaissance coming up in terms of the future that we're looking at as we sort of plow our way through COVID? Tell us a little bit, just a quick snapshot of the book and perhaps the lessons you'd now draw.
I sort of published this book back in 2013, and the Digital Medieval title was very much a sort of reference to the kind of crudeness but also early innovation that was going on in the first period of up to the sort of first dot-com bubble and so on. I'm actually in the process of recasting that book and actually rewriting it. And I am going to call it Digital Renaissance.
Is this going to be our Bittersweet Symphony? Am I going to be taking you to the court? I said it first and it's on air.
No, I think I trailed it in the book, actually. And there is a certain historical logic to this. But I think, apart from the debate that we can have about whether the Renaissance was really more creative than the medieval period, or whether actually huge amounts of innovation were happened in the medieval period, which current scholars apparently would argue was actually the case. We have seen this incredible flowering. And what's happened between, you know, 2000 and here we are into 2020 is that we have seen the kind of the full flight of so many of these ideas coming to fruition. So, you know, 1,000 flowers bloomed in the first dot-com bubble. 20 years on, we actually have commercial services that are rendering all of that real. And that's, you know, in some respects it's gratifying, and in other respects has all kinds of, now it appears, and we are discovering, disconcerting undercurrents and aspects of those things that we're less happy with. So, you know, after the Renaissance, perhaps there's another decline that will come, but we'll see.
Well, I mean, we'll focus on the Renaissance for a moment, because obviously you are a Renaissance man when it comes to digital. I mean, you were one of the co-founders of the pioneering music subscription service Uplister, often compared to Spotify. You spotted that market of streaming. I was reading a piece that you wrote in City AM about how life would be so much harder if we didn't have Joe Exotic in it, in terms of Netflix, that actually that whole streaming, that whole digital opportunity. I mean, I can remember the first time I heard Spotify and thinking, this is witchcraft, this is amazing, what am I going to do with all my CDs? But you were at that early stage of spotting the change that I guess that was going to have such a sort of influential piece, and it was all digital. I mean, how far can digital take us, do you think, in terms of the human experience?
Well, I think I think the experience of lockdown has showed us that we want it to take us a lot further, because it's still not a great experience. And although we've probably developed and transformed our digital adoption, if you like, more rapidly in the last 6 months since we first were locked down back in March, than some people predicted it would take another 5 years to get this far. So the fact that we're all communicating the way we are is both an affirmation of the value of the digital platforms, and at the same time, I think, you know, all of us are acutely aware of how they remain inadequate. You know, it still is a terribly poor experience compared with real life. So we've got an enormous way to go, and there are all sorts of interesting developments around, you know, and we've been involved with some of those at Digital Catapult around the development of volumetric capture in virtual reality, for example, which looks to create much, much more lifelike experiences in a virtual world. But we are still at such an early stage of development around that, and there are still so many developments and so much powerful computing required in order to actually create an experience which is even close to what we experience in real life.
Mm. I mean, I want to come on to Digital Catapult, but before then, I mean, just to keep with the trend spotting for a moment. You have your own Lessons from Leaders podcast, the Future Networks. A lot of what that seems to show is the power of 5G, the power of the Internet of Things, a real sense of the shape of things to come. What excites you when you look to that near-term future? What can we look forward to? What have others said to you that you just think, that'll be brilliant, should be investing in that?
Yes. I think one of the things that we're seeing, and we've seen it for a while, but it's continuing, is more and more high definition experiences. So what digital is really able to deliver at its ultimate is something that becomes so close to reality that it's hard to distinguish between the two. Now, we're not there yet, but supercomputing capability, the kind of power of a 5G network with low latency and high media push through, those kinds of capabilities are going to give us experiences that are still a gleam in the eye at the moment. And whether that's in the quality of the audio and an immersive surround audio experience, or whether that's in a visual immersion, I think those things are going to come. Now, I'm not a great believer that virtual reality itself is necessarily the be-all and end-all. I think in lots of ways it's quite limited. I think augmented reality is a much more interesting and compelling proposition, in which all of that vivid, visceral experience that we've sensed is possible within virtual reality starts to actually merge with the real world, be superimposed upon it, exist in the context of real places. I think that holds really, really interesting potential. Whether it's about understanding what, you know, the drama of historical events that took place in a particular location. So, you know, going to the Tower of London and being able to actually engage with characters who seem as if they are as lifelike as you and I are, but from the 16th century, telling us about what went on there. That kind of experience, I think, is you know, we're not there yet, but it's coming.
I was going to ask, and how near is that near-term future? Because, you know, a lot of technologists that I interview will talk with great excitement about the ability of computers to overtake human beings in their ability to learn, and the world of the 100-year life, that so many things are right on the doorstep. But of course, this year feels a year where some of that might feel, dare I say, a bit like hubris. I mean, have we been overly excited about the realities of digital, or actually are we at the beginning of that new age?
Absolutely at the beginning of it. And if you think about the kind of moral outrage and scandal and paranoia about deep fakes, and the more recent fear that is starting to creep in about fakes, i.e. very, very lifelike pictures of people who don't exist at all, who are created by artificial intelligence, you start to begin to enter what that world might be like. And unfortunately, we're sort of entering it from a rather dystopic kind of perspective. So we're looking at it and thinking about all the ways in which these things can be used negatively. But actually, the potential on the positive side, and from an educational perspective, from a cultural perspective, I think there's incredible potential there. So we've got to have to figure out how to regulate it, but the opportunity is huge.
Well, let's talk about where you're developing it, because the Digital Catapult, that's where you're the CEO. I'm sort of envisaging of you sort of like a modern day Q, sort of like wandering around, equipping the sort of like commercial versions of James Bond with all the latest digital kit. You're working with small companies, large companies, really driving, I guess, innovation and discovery in that digital world. Tell us about a typical day at the Catapult.
Well, obviously at the moment we're in lockdown, so there's not an awful lot to describe. And, you know, we're running about 80 projects a day and they're all running online at the moment. But, you know, I think let me describe a typical day. Andy Haldane from the Bank of England giving a keynote speech at a conference we've organised about agent-based modelling, how you evaluate innovation in the digital age. And then a group of startups pitching the UK and Europe's top investors with their latest and greatest ideas about machine intelligence and machine learning businesses. You know, 10 of them in a row, boom, 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 all talking about the things that they're doing, followed by a meeting with a big telco vendor who is looking to really engage with UK industries and try and find ways of really helping them build their business case for investment. And then followed probably by a session where we sit down together as a team and think about how do we make sure that our entire team retains its mental health throughout all of it and doesn't go completely nuts.
And all of this with the glorious backdrop of St. Pancras behind you, St. Pancras Station.
St. Pancras on one side as the gateway to Europe, and the British Library on the other side as the gateway to knowledge, iconography.
I mean, it really is an iconic location. When you look out of those windows, you get a sense of, those, you know, iconic buildings. But of course, far below you are the city streets, people walking around, and up there is this sort of brave new world, this brave new future being created. I mean, you talked about, obviously, people are working from home, away from the Catapult at the moment. Given the subject matter of the digital world, as your expertise, how match fit have you all found it yourselves in terms of working in a completely different way, a much less physical way than previously?
Yeah, I think the translation from everyone piling into an office every day to working from home, and 150 people in our case, instantly overnight reverting to working from home was a challenge, but I think probably less of a challenge for us as a digitally oriented business than a lot of other companies who rely much more on the physical and the manual. But having said that, we've put an enormous focus all the way through this on people maintaining a work-life balance. You know, the problem with being on Zoom 24 hours a day is you can be on it 24 hours a day and it would kill you, you know, and so, you know, but everything is structured. Spontaneity is very hard to do. you've got to build in physical movement, you've got to build in breaks, you've got to build in going out into the fresh air. It's really weird. I mean, you probably experienced it too, but you sort of think you're fine, but maybe I'll just take a 10-minute walk around the block. And you go outside and you have that 10-minute walk, and when you come back, you realize, wow, that really helped.
The real world matters. In terms of the, you know, obviously a big part of the sell, I guess, of the Catapult is a collaborative environment, large and small companies working together. I was reading about some extraordinary work that's being done to train nurses virtually. A very quick sort of bringing to life of some of the projects that listeners might be interested in.
Yeah, well, that was part of our response to COVID very quickly was we'd already have quite a close relationship with Microsoft and a virtual reality studio that we established called Dimension. And when COVID hit, we kind of started to think about, well, how could we help and what could we do? And to be honest with you, I was kind of skeptical that in the face of the sort of emergency, that medical teams would be very interested in trying to work out how to use augmented reality to help themselves. But what emerged was, A, that there was an appetite for that, and B, that the level of training and the speed of training that they needed to get through to train hundreds of nurses and doctors on how to, you know, just simple things like how to put on PPE, for example, in a way that was safe and hygienic. Turned out that actually using augmented reality to do that and showing people in 360 degrees what that looked like from every angle was something that was incredibly helpful. So that was something that we did and was used in Nightingale hospitals, and I think is, you know, is still being used now by Public Health England and Health Education England. So we've, you know, that was a really interesting thing. But there's so many different examples of things we've been doing. One of my favourite companies that came through our Augmentor program last year was a company called Extend Robotics, who were about four really bright graduates out of Imperial College, who had the idea of creating flying drone robots who could do maintenance of things high above the ground. And so flying robots is obviously appealing to anyone who's sort of vaguely geeky, but actually the incredibly practical application. So it turns out that the world spends about £7 billion a year maintaining telegraph poles, and that most of that money is spent driving people to the thing, making sure they're safe while they climb up it, then spending about 5 minutes up there repairing a panel or something, and then making sure they get back down safely again. So if you could get a drone to do that, the savings are huge, and they've done incredible work. And they now have a drone that can go and perch on a pole 50 feet above the ground, that can grip a Phillips screwdriver head and open a panel. And all the controls for that are all done in virtual reality by someone on the ground.
It's extraordinary because, I mean, this is the world that I get very excited about thinking about. I've got two young daughters, and I think about the world they're going to grow up into, where drones go from, you know, effectively a bit of a specialist sport, whether it's a kind of a hobby or some very specialist application, into it's just going to be what we see. It's going to not even probably appear to be technology. I mean, it's interesting that I read on your LinkedIn profile that your goal is to always understand technology trends, the digital landscape, and where the consumer is heading next. And I guess so much of today is about, this interview is about where we are heading next. I suppose to take you back to your earliest days, I mean, here you are. We haven't even mentioned your PhD in English literature, but we have mentioned the music, your music career. We've mentioned your role as an author, an investor, founder, speaker, CEO. What did the young Jeremy think he was going to do? What would he make of that CV description? Now?
I have no idea. I thought I was going to have to be a poet. I thought that poetry was probably the most important thing in my life for quite a long time, and actually I recently had the experience. I got sent by the British Library a recording of some poetry readings that I'd done in 1986. Which was a really weird experience to listen back to it, and quite emotional actually.
But I mean, you mentioned the British Library. I mean, creativity is also, it's not just the sort of the harder applications of technology. I mean, a big part of your life is the creative industries. You're on the board of the Creative Industries Council and a trustee of the British Library. That those softer values are clearly things that matter. Do you think that in this you know, sometimes quite alpha rush to the kind of technological age, that there are some of the softer aspects, like books, for example, and other sorts of things that may well be the casualties that over time we come to think, oh, they were the CDs of their time, or that's it. Or do you think there is a more respectful balance?
Well, I don't think that you know, the work of the British Library is one of the softer values. I think the work of the British Library is absolutely at the core of our culture, and I think you know, it's a deliberately provocative and excellent question, Michael. But I mean, the reality of course is that a universe of knowledge exists in books, and books are more than just the knowledge that they contain. They also, their physical nature says a lot about where they come from and how we experience that and understand that information. And so I think the role of the British Library in particular, and libraries more generally, as being sources of information, knowledge, guidance, stimulus, provocation, and encouragement, you know, are absolutely at the heart of everything that we all. It's not just in the arts. I mean, I think the sciences also, and technology, has an enormous amount to draw from written work.
But I suppose what I'm driving at is that, you know, you'll hear government ministers that will talk about the importance of science, technology, and mathematics, and you know, a lot of what you're talking about is a more creative, less tangible, I guess, expression of some of those values, you know, in terms of how they feed into things like productivity and realizing potential. And yet what we know is that those intangible assets are, I guess, where the magic is.
Well, I think they're where the humanity is. And I think that those of us that are kind of have gone through as much of the digital experience as I have, are starting to come out the other side of that and realizing that we need to retain our humanity in all of this as well, and that the emotional and the empathetic aspects of doing business are just as important as the alpha male aggressive target busting, and that's not to say that we shouldn't have that aggression or that we shouldn't have that kind of ambition, but the way that we achieve it best is through understanding and empathy with our fellow human, and for not forgetting that. And I think that you know, if you look at the way that executives in Silicon Valley, for example, at the moment are increasingly instructing their children to remove screens of any kind from their rooms for extended periods of time, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's not just me saying it. I think the more digital your life becomes, the more you realize that you need life as well as digital. So I you know, it seems ironic in a way that I should be a proponent of that in the face of this, but I think that's what it, yeah.
But I think that, you know, if I was to sort of look at a golden thread in your career, I think that quest for understanding is actually quite an important part of what, from the outside in, it looks like what makes you tick. I mean, you know, you're a fluent French speaker and being bilingual, I noted that you said it allows you to have different thought processes and makes you think about different points of views. I mean, curiosity is a big part of the Jeremy, I guess, we've come to know, isn't it?
It has to be, I think, from my point of view. If I stopped learning, I think that would be the end of things. Yes, you know, look, the world is an extraordinary place, and there is still an enormous amount that we do not understand and know nothing about. And that's daunting when you think about it, but also hugely exciting.
I mean, and I guess just last question. I mean, you've talked in your advice that goes with this lockdown list. Your advice to listeners is to trust your instincts. That when a tough choice comes, prioritize your instincts. They won't lead you astray. But I suppose you've got to feed your instincts with knowledge and insights. I mean, is that been, you think, what your lesson has been in life?
Yes, I think we all feed our brains, and our brains do extraordinary things. And I think if on a few occasions where I've made mistakes in life, it's because I didn't follow my instinct and I went with some sort of intellectually argued idea, rather than just following my gut and going, yeah, no, that's where we should go. And so, when you go out for a run or when you go for a swim, when you come off those experiences, your brain brings you answers to questions that you were struggling with before you went. That says that we do have something extraordinary in our heads that we still don't understand what it does or how it works. To me, that's the most exciting thing, that we'll learn more as time goes by.
What a wonderful place to leave it, Jeremy. Thank you so much for joining me on Changemakers. A music maestro, a digital dynamo, an advocate for aspiring tech titans, and a champion for creativity. Little wonder he knows a thing or two about a world of change. And his advice to you is simply this: when a tough choice comes, prioritize your instincts. They won't lead you astray. Join me next time for Changemakers.